This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 157. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products. Whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it, I'm Mike.
And I'm Dave.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. How are you doing this week, Dave?
I'm doing very well again, Mike. Thanks for having me back.
I had mentioned to the listeners several weeks ago that one of the things I was doing for Audit Shark was going out and submitting it to a bunch of different application directories where they do announcements for web-based startups and new applications that are out there, like BetaList and things like that. And a few people had emailed into the show asking whether I would share that list. I already went through and shared it with them. But one of our listeners named Robert Graham, who has been at MicroConf, he went through and he actually created a much bigger list than I had. We'll link to it in the show notes, but if anyone's interested in taking a look at that, it's over at whitetailsoftware.com. And as I said, we'll link to it in the show notes. He's got a list of, I think, between 40 and 50 different websites that you could go to. But I did want to make sure that I shared that with people. Today, we're going to be talking about plugins and info products versus SaaS products, and primarily about how to get started with a plugin or an info product and kind of contrasting it to a SaaS application a little bit. When you're looking at these sorts of things, plugins and info products versus SaaS is really just a trade-off that you're making. There's a lot of different trade-offs that you're looking at when you decide to go for an info product or a plugin, and it's just important to be aware of what some of those differences are. And the first one is the speed to market. With each of these types of products, the plugins and info products, they tend to be fast to market versus a SaaS application, which can take you a long time to get to market. Dave, you've got a couple of WordPress plugins, right?
That's correct. Yeah, I have AWPCP and Business Directory plugin. And I also have an info product, too, about how to buy websites. And I would definitely say that compared to the time required to develop a full product, even in MVP mode, getting something like an info product out is actually much, much faster, especially when it's an area of expertise that you already have.
So really what you're saying here is that, you know, in terms of the different types of products, there's a sliding scale where with an info product, it can be very, very fast to get to market. And then with a plugin, it will take you a little bit longer. But then with a full-blown SaaS application, it could take you substantially longer, possibly even exponentially longer.
That's right. Depends on how complex that SaaS product is. If you had something that was as involved as Drip, I mean, how long has Rob been developing that? That's gone on for a long time compared to the fact that he was able to collect a bunch of articles and put them together for Start Small, Stay Small, and in a comparatively smaller amount of time, create something that he could sell immediately and provide a great deal of value and get customers for.
So another thing to keep in mind is revenue sustainability. And with info products and plugins, you get little to no revenue sustainability. And that's really about monthly recurring income versus a SaaS application where you can get that monthly recurring income. Occasionally, depending on whether you've got these annual plans or not, you may have to deal with it on an annual basis. But the idea is that you've got this recurring income, much higher price points to deal with versus the info products and plugins. Now, what about marketing complexity? I know you've got, with your different plugins, you've got a lot of different modules that you sell with those. I mean, what are your thoughts on the marketing complexity?
It's something that would go basically from info product to plugin to SaaS in terms of like from simplest to most complex here. So when you talk about an info product is very much narrowly focused on a highly defined problem. So that might be something like a guide to web application design, or it might be how can I charge more as a freelancer? I mean, there's a very specific problem, and that one info product is going to provide a very specific answer to it. When you move up the scale to plugins, initially that plugin is probably going to be very focused on something that is more simple. But with my plugins, for example, the applicability of that particular plugin depends very much on what kind of a site that it's installed in. So for Business Directory, somebody might be using it in a kind of a Yelp capacity where they're trying to make a site that's all about ratings. And another one might actually be trying to make Yellow Pages where it's actually more important to show locations and directories. So I have different modules that you can add on, one that specifically supports ratings and one that specifically supports maps. So you kind of morph the core product depending on what it is you're looking to do based on the customer's target need there. And then you can go up a whole other level beyond that when you get into SaaS applications where you have much more general problems to solve. So if you're talking about somebody like a MailChimp, it might be as simple as, well, I just want to collect email addresses and send out blasts to them. And then later on, it might be, well, now I need to segment this list and say, okay, I want you to send this particular email to this subsegment of the list, or maybe I want to A/B test emails across the list. And I want to try out one version of it to, say, 10% of my list, and I want to try out another version to another 10%, and then whichever one did better, I want to send that to the remaining 80%. And that's something that is definitely a much more complex use case than just sort of collecting emails in the first place.
One of the things that you just talked about, it kind of overlaps in feature complexity as well, because as you said, something like MailChimp might have all these different use case scenarios, and that goes into the feature complexity. When I was talking about marketing complexity, what I was kind of getting at was that when you're faced with marketing complexity, it is substantially easier to explain to somebody what your offering is if you know exactly what that type of person is going to be. Because if you solve a very, very specific problem, so it's, say you're solving 2 + 2, the answer is going to be 4, but you're trying to explain that to people in a way that they're going to understand, versus if you're trying to explain and you've got all these different variables in place, you know, all these different people who might be using the product, you know, maybe you've got designers and developers, managers, things like that. When you've got all these different moving parts, it can be very difficult to explain to people what your position is because you don't necessarily know who is visiting the site at the time. So you have to essentially multiply the footprint of your website. You have to talk to different types of people and in different ways. And that's really what I was getting at with the marketing complexity, which I think that the feature complexity also factors into this. As you get more features, you seem like you just naturally end up with more marketing complexity because of that.
Absolutely. You know, some of the stuff that you were talking about, you're right. I jumped right into the feature complexity thing here and didn't really talk about that marketing aspect. If you have something that is addressing the needs of various kinds of audiences, like I'm thinking of appointment reminder for Patrick McKenzie. He's got a lot of different kinds of audiences he's trying to target this thing to, one of which is like medical professionals, but you might also do it to massage therapists. Now, that's an entirely different set of keywords he's got to target, different landing pages, different messages, possibly different pain points to make it sound like you really understand their particular niche. He's going to have to cater those pages in a very specific way so that the massage therapists feel like, yes, I really know that this person gets my problem here. I want to buy their product. That is definitely going to be much harder than if you have, you know, a very simple e-product or ebook where you're saying, okay, I want to tell you how to raise your prices as a freelancer. That's a very easy marketing thing by comparison.
And the terminology could very well be different between some of those different fields as well. That also adds to the challenges. So just keep in mind that there's a lot of these challenges that you're going to have to deal with depending on how complex the offering is. Something else that factors into it is the operational requirements. And by operational requirements, I'm really talking about how much it takes for you in terms of your resources and your support costs and things like that to maintain the business operating. So for something like an info product, let's say that your website goes down. Well, if you have an info product, who does that affect? It doesn't really affect your customers because they've already purchased the product and they have already received it, so they don't have to come back to your website. It will affect the people who are coming to your website to buy it, but if they can't get to your website at all, then they're not quite your customer yet, and sure, they have a problem with that, but the person who that ultimately affects is you. Now, with a SaaS application, if you are hosting an application for a customer, and if, whether it's infrastructure related or just ancillary to, you know, their core business, it can still be a problem for them because you have to make sure that that website and that application are up and running at all times. So you have to install monitoring services. You probably want at least a little bit of redundancy. You have to make sure that you're doing backups and all these additional operational things. And that's in addition to the support burden that you're going to bear, which is going to be medium to very high for a SaaS application and, you know, low to medium for an info product or a plugin of any kind.
Absolutely. There's definitely a higher stress level when you have a software service application because of that.
Oh, definitely. And as I said before, the one thing that really factors into that is, you know, how tightly integrated into your customer's business is your product. If it's core to their operation, if they need your product in order to do business, then obviously your support costs and your operational requirements are going to skyrocket. You're going to have a lot more redundancy and a lot more things in place than if it's just something where, you know, they go into your product maybe at the end of the day or, you know, once a week or something like that.
Absolutely. Very different. Yeah.
So next we're going to talk about if you've taken a look at these trade-offs and you've decided that you want to go down the road of building a plugin of some kind. Dave, you've got some experience building plugins. How would somebody go about learning WordPress development? And essentially, where do they get started with that?
Well, that's a great question. Well, first I'd like to say that, you know, this is not the only type of plugin that somebody could actually do. There are other ecosystems, but I think WordPress is probably one of the most commercially viable and hottest economically that you can really tap into right now. There just seems to be a lot of energy and money in the community as a whole. So it's probably a good place to focus your time if you're going to do a plugin of any kind. But when you get started, there's tons and tons of tutorials and examples and, you know, how to write a WordPress plugin that have been written at this point that just Googling something like how do I write a WordPress plugin is probably going to get you a million results right off the bat. Starting from that, you can then go to the WordPress Codex, codex.wordpress.org, and get, you know, the basics of what are the things in the WordPress API that are important. You know, how do I actually apply the calls and the API into my plugin here? What are some architectural considerations that I need to have for a plugin? And then going at with that, you can also look up WordPress best practices. You know, that's another great thing you could Google for. You could spend easily 2 weeks on just those two activities right there.
That's a good number to know, but roughly 2 weeks for just that. I mean, how long would it take you start to finish if you, let's say I started today, how long would it take me to be able to get the basic knowledge to create just a very simple plugin?
Obviously, that's going to vary quite a bit on the person who is writing that plugin. You know, if you have somebody who's a senior developer coming from a background that allows you to understand PHP very rapidly. So if you've been doing C, C++, Java, Python, and Ruby to a lesser extent, or just PHP directly, if you can understand the syntax very quickly, then you're going to be able to be productive quite fast. If you're not as technical, if you're not as facile in one of those languages right there, it might take you a little bit longer. And you know, that's going to be very much dependent on your learning style. If I were to say, how long would it take a senior developer who knew these things in advance to actually come up to speed on the WordPress API and be able to write some very basic stuff in a plugin? I would say you could do that in under 2 weeks.
Okay. So when you're talking about going to looking through these APIs and best practices and the WordPress.org repository, there's also additional information that you can get from those places, not just the technical side of things, but you can also find some underserved niches and abandoned plugins there as well, right?
Oh, yeah. In fact, you know, several people have asked me, well, you know, I'd like to do a WordPress plugin. You did these particular WordPress plugins for classifieds and business directories. How can I find something that I can serve as well? And one thing that I found is that by going and just researching WordPress.org, you go in there and type a search on something that you might be interested in or something that you might think, okay, well, if I was building a WordPress site and I wanted to add an events manager, or I wanted to add classifieds or a business directory, or I wanted to be able to manage RSS feeds, or these are just things I'm pulling off the top of my head. But that sort of stuff, you can find out what plugins exist in there. And taking a look at those, you can see, well, when was the last time it was updated? Is the support forum something that looks like people are posting, but the author isn't really responding? If you look at this plugin and there's a lot of people that are posting in the support forum, that indicates that there's certainly some level of popularity for it, but depending on how the author is responding, maybe that plugin is not doing a good job of supporting it. So you can go through the WordPress repository there to actually find some good ideas. And then once you've got an idea there, another possibility is that you could actually bootstrap your plugin development by actually forking an existing plugin on WordPress.org. Since everything that goes into WordPress.org is under GPL version 2 licensing, you are actually allowed to grab somebody's source code, lock, stock, and barrel, and start from scratch on that particular plugin if you wanted to. There are pluses and minuses to that, and you might incur the wrath of the author doing so. But in some cases, I know, for example, there's a competitor to Business Directory. The guy actually started his directory plugin using an older kind of abandoned listing plugin for an address book. So that's certainly a viable way to go about it as well.
Now, you mentioned that everything that goes up on WordPress.org is covered by the GPL. I mean, how can you go about building a business? I mean, are there specific business models that you can put together for these plugins? I mean, it wouldn't seem like you can sell your WordPress plugins directly from there, but you could have free plugins that lead to premium modules or something along those lines. I mean, what other sorts of business models could people be looking at or entertain as possibilities for WordPress plugins that they're creating?
Well, it turns out that there's four that I can think of that are viable business models. Now, like you said, WordPress.org, they're very strict about you can't sell anything through there. In fact, if you directly have a link on there that isn't something like a donate, they tend to frown on that. But they're okay if you like point to a site that says, okay, here's the professional version of the plugin on soandso.site, and you can buy it there. But, you know, you kind of have to keep it sort of moderated, I guess, is the way to put it. But the four business models that I know of from other plugins are things like freemium offerings. So you have the free plugin in the repository, and then off of an external site, you offer a pro upgrade. So the plugin that I can think of that does this is the Pinterest Pinit plugin by Phil Dirksen. Another one would be the premium add-on model, and that's exactly what My Business Directory does. So you get the core plugin in WordPress.org, and then you can buy add-ons to it. It's not really an upgrade to the core plugin so much as it is just things that enhance the functionality to it. And then there's a number of things that you can add on to it. There are some where the plugin itself is actually sort of a gateway to a SaaS product. So Hittail is a great example of this, where there's a WordPress plugin that goes onto your site that actually does your keyword tracking, and then that feeds that data back to Hittail. And then Hittail will give you further suggestions based on what that WordPress plugin is collecting. So it's not so much that the plugin itself is making revenue, but it's enhancing an external SaaS site to basically give you another channel of customers. And then the fourth model is where people actually offer paid support for the plugin. So you get it, you download it for free from WordPress.org, but the level of the plugin might be complex enough that you really need some help in actually setting it up, configuring it, maybe skinning it. That sort of activity is paid for directly on a site. Gravity Forms is an example of a plugin that does that.
So we've talked a little bit about some of the different trade-offs. We've talked about how to learn how to do WordPress plugin development and a little bit about where to get some ideas and some of the business models that you can put behind those ideas. Most of the stuff that we've talked about so far relates directly to, you know, WordPress and plugin development. The other side of it is info products. And people might be wondering, where do I get an idea for an info product that would be marketable? And I think that this is where a lot of people really underestimate their own capabilities. Anyone with a career as a professional developer has something that they can teach somebody and charge for. Pretty much everybody. And I can almost guarantee that. For example, you, Dave, you could easily put together a book on WordPress development. You don't have to be an expert. And that's the part where I think that people kind of struggle with is like, oh, I'm not an expert. The fact is you don't have to be an expert in order to teach people what you know. Typically, if you've been working in a particular field or a particular area, you tend to have a lot more knowledge than the average developer about whatever that specific field is. What other sorts of examples can you think of?
Oh, well, there's two great examples of guys that I met at MicroConf. There's Nathan Berry. He's got a couple of different ebooks out there that I'm aware of. One is a book on app design, and another one is about a web design guide. And clearly, these are both areas of expertise of Nathan's that he's acquired as a developer over the years. And he just simply took the time to write it down and share his knowledge and experience. Same thing with Brennan Dunn and his Freelancer's Business Guide. You know, it's basically a guide that solves a very specific problem that freelancers commonly have, and that is, how much should I charge for what it is I do? And if I'm charging already, how can I raise my rates to get better income out of my livelihood? And these questions are things that all freelancers have, and certainly Brennan himself struggled directly with. but he just took the time to write it down, think about it very thoroughly. I think he, you know, spoke with a number of freelancers to get additional input from outside of his own sphere of influence. And he created this great product that is selling quite well based on his experience. And he certainly wasn't an expert on it before he started that guide. I spoke with him about it. He knew a little bit about it from his own experience, but mostly it was about him being willing to research it and come up with something that he could teach to others in a clear and concise manner. That's what made it a valuable product.
So that's one of the ways that you can do it. Another way you can do it is to just find something that you think is interesting and you want to learn about and want to be able to share that information. So, for example, like one of the things that I have an interest in from, you know, years and years ago is robotics. And it's partially because I've done assembly language programming and done hardware and software interfacing. And I've always found it kind of fascinating. But that might be something where if I decided that in the future, oh, I kind of want to learn a little bit more about this and maybe build an information product or an ebook about how to do it. Maybe I'd put together something on how to interface with the Raspberry Pi or something like that. And I think that something like that would probably do reasonably well, and their chances are really good that somebody else has already done something similar. And if you haven't, just look around, feel free to rip off that idea. If you have the inclination and the interest, you can definitely learn enough about a particular topic that you can share that information and charge for it.
I've seen the same sort of thing that sort of plays over and over again as like the beginner's guide to whatever, or how I learned X in Y days. There's lots of people that have gone out that say how I figured out Ruby for the first time, or how I went and learned robotics from scratch, not knowing anything about electronics. Those sorts of guides seem to be very popular. So even if you didn't know something, you could write a guide that was kind of following that theme on a subject that you're interested in, and then approach it as a complete novice and basically record your experience along the way with the intent of making an info product out of it.
Yeah. And again, this isn't about pitching or positioning yourself as an expert in a field. It's really about positioning yourself as somebody who is capable of teaching other people. And as long as you have a message that you can put together that's clear and people can easily understand it, people are going to be willing to pay for it. And that leads to another point, which is when people are looking around for information on the internet, sure, they can go and find free information all over the place. I mean, if you want to start a business, for example, there's tons and tons of free information out there. But there are still people who go out and buy books on how to build a company and how to build a startup. And why do they do that? And it's because that information is compiled in a way that is easy for them to consume and has theoretically had a lot of people look at it and provide feedback and get it to a quality level that's acceptable for general consumption. Don't be afraid to put a price on any sort of info product that you put together.
So speaking of prices and info products, I want to share an idea that Nathan Berry actually did, and it was part of his talk at MicroConf. He has essentially one product, and that's his various ebooks. But in addition to the ebook, he added on additional, let's call them value services here. So he's got the ebook itself, and then he's also got an audio version of the ebook, and then he's also got product videos that go with it and some additional resources. And instead of just offering the ebook by itself, he's offered things at various price tiers. So you've got sort of the value-driven ebook for just the people that want the bare bones. And then somebody who wants a little bit more, they get the ebook with the audio and some screencasts that go along with that. And then for somebody who wants sort of like the Grand Prix package, they get the audiobook, the ebook, the screencasts, and all the additional resources that go along with that. And they've got this great set of price points where you can really actually increase the overall value of what it is you're offering. So even if you've started with an info product, you can actually increase the value as you're going along by finding ways to, you know, create these value adds to it.
Another way to do that is through a simple licensing trick. And I think that Patrick McKenzie was the first one that I saw to do this, but I know that Nathan Berry does this as well. But essentially charging more for the same product for a slightly different license that allows them to distribute the product within their company. So with Patrick McKenzie, I think he has an email course where I think he doubled the price if you want to download it and put it on an internal company server and share it with people in the company. Otherwise, you just get like a single license for one person. It's almost like buying multiple copies of a book for everybody in the company. Well, with that other license, you can download the stuff hosted on an internal company server, and then anybody in the company can view it. And all it is a simple, please use this license if you're going to save it to an internal server and make it freely available for everybody in the company. So that's definitely another way that you can drive the price point up without doing a heck of a lot of extra work. So let's talk about, how do you go about delivering these types of products? What sorts of methods have you used in the past to distribute, like, your WordPress plugins and your book, for example?
Well, for me, obviously being a WordPress guy, WordPress was sort of a natural fit for the sites that I'm actually distributing them on. So I have WordPress-based sites that I use, WordPress plugins that are shopping carts and digital download managers. And even in the case of my website buyer's guide, you know, there was a PDF delivery plugin on there that I added to that. And then I also added on affiliate programs to those as well. So those are all things that are managed through WordPress plugins. You drop them in, configure it a little bit, throw a theme on it, and you know, you've got yourself kind of a website in a box, sort of minimal effort. But that's certainly not the only thing that you can do. What are some things that you've actually done or seen other people do, Mike?
For my Altiris training site, I have it integrated into Wistia, and I'm just taking credit cards and sending them through Stripe. And then once they've paid for it, then they get access to the rest of the site and they can view the videos. But other things that I've seen people use are Gumroad, for example, eJunkie is another one. And then Fetch App and Pulley are two others that are similar in that they basically allow you to take your content, you upload it, and they will handle a lot of the front-end shopping cart stuff so that you don't have to. And then, you know, some of them are monthly fees. Some of them just charge you for hosting the files, or they'll take a percentage of the sales. So there's a lot of different services out there that will do it for you if you don't want to go down the road of setting up your own WordPress site or integrating into Stripe. Gumroad is one that I've heard a lot more and more lately. But again, there's a lot of different options out there for people.
Sure. You could also publish it on Amazon.com directly if you wanted to. I know a few people that have tried that route as well.
Yeah, I forgot about that. Amazon has their own digital publishing service as well. So if you wanted to go the route of actually having a physical book, they have an on-demand print service that you can use. And there's other publishers other than Amazon that have an on-demand model as well.
Right.
So I think the last thing we want to talk about today is, what sorts of limitations are you placing on yourself by going down the road of an info product or a plugin?
Well, you know, I think the one thing that is the most limiting of going either of those routes is that because you are not going to a recurring revenue model right away, that you're constantly in this, I've got to keep selling it mode. So, you know, you're always going out there every month starting from scratch and having to dig up customers again. Sometimes, in some cases, you can, you know, resell some things to your customers, but it's not like everybody that was a customer last month can be sold to again this month. So that can be kind of a grind, and ultimately, I think that tends to limit the amount of revenue that you can pull out of one of these things on a long-term basis.
Yeah, and that goes back to the business model itself. It just makes things more difficult when you're selling any product that is not recurring, because you're essentially starting from ground zero every single month. I mean, you're always starting at zero. It can become a grind after a while, especially if you haven't automated a lot of your marketing efforts. And that can be somewhat challenging. I would also think that for different products, especially in the info product space, you will probably run into, I'll say, a cap on the maximum revenue that you can pull in from any given product, because eventually you would saturate that market.
Yeah, and I think it's not just market saturation you have to be concerned about, but I think info products, let's call it an expiration date on them, because whatever it is that you wrote about it, unless it's like something truly evergreen that like you write it now and it's going to be good for the next 10 years, I've not seen info products that don't have to be occasionally refreshed. For example, my website buyer's guide, you know, it's a couple of years old at this point. I probably ought to go in and actually get current screenshots of Flippa here, but I haven't done that. So that's something that's definitely getting a little stale in that book.
That's definitely a maintenance issue that you have to be aware of for info products, is they may very well have a shelf life. I can think of a lot of books that I purchased in the past where I look at them now, and even though it may have seemed evergreen at the time, things have changed enough that they are not necessarily as relevant anymore. So that's definitely an interesting point to make.
I mean, that's going to be true regardless of the kind of product that you have. I think it's just very, very poignant on info products. The applicability of that product to a given market, not taking into account saturation, is definitely going to decay over time. Whereas if you're still providing value with a SaaS application, as long as you continue to deliver that value on day one, day 365, day 730, it's not going to be as difficult.
Well, cool. So I hope that this has given the listeners a good idea of what the advantages and trade-offs of going for a plugin or an info product versus a SaaS product. One thing that I think has become more mainstream is to build a info product up front before you build a SaaS product so that you can get a lot more in-depth knowledge about a particular market and then use that as a launching point to build a SaaS product around where that info product is. One of the people that I've seen kind of leverage this technique, and probably the one I've seen leverage it the best, is Nathan Berry with his Authority book, where it's a book on self-publishing, and he uses a lot of the ideas from publishing his first two books and uses that information and shares it with people in his book called Authority. And then he also has a software product called ConvertKit, which is also aimed at people who are doing self-publishing. So essentially what he's doing is he's creating an overlapping market where he's got an info product that kind of leads into a SaaS application. And then I think that Brennan Dunn also does this with some of his products around PlanScope and his info product, Double Your Freelancing Rate.
Absolutely. So, yes, he does.
I'll say it's starting to become a trend. It is certainly not a bad trend to follow. If you can get a info product out there very, very quickly and then use that to learn enough about a particular market or use it to gauge interest in that particular market, you can leverage that information to build a SaaS app around it, or you can use it as a determining factor to decide not to build a SaaS app, because again, building that SaaS app is going to be a very major investment of time, energy, and resources, and it may not be worth it. And just building that info product could be enough to tell you whether or not it's going to be worth it or not.
Absolutely. And in fact, just building that info product does a couple of things. I mean, it allows you to sort of dip your toes into the water of how do I market this thing? How do I handle the sales? Are there support issues I've got to deal with? I mean, sort of like baby steps to the real thing, right? Where you're actually getting experience in running this whole business from end to end. In addition, I know that Nathan and Brennan both built their launch lists for PlanScope and ConvertKit using their ebooks as a way to get people's emails for their future products. So not only are you building that product, but you're also building an audience to sell a product to.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And this is in some ways kind of mirrors what Rob and I have discussed in the past about a ladder approach where you build these smaller products that enable you to learn the things that you need to be able to make larger products successful.
Yeah, definitely.
But I think that pretty much wraps us up for our discussion on plugins and info products. If you have a question or comment, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690 or email it to us at questions@startupsforrestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Startups or by RSS at startupsforrestofus.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.